From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Skier visits in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons are up 69% over the past 25 years. That's great news for the resorts, but not so great for the commuting ski bum. A new study reports that on peak ski days, skiers are spending up to 3 hours in the car just to get to and from Alta and Snowbird, creating a red snake of brake lights through the canyon. Salt Lake County, the U.S. Forest Service, and others are working to figure out ways to solve the congestion and parking issues, which will only get worse. And today on the program, we're talking about transportation in the canyons and the transit options on the table. Plus a profile of the acclaimed landscape artist, Utah's own LeConte Stewart. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Traffic congestion, a lack of parking, and the competing needs of pedestrians, bikes, vehicles, they aren't just city issues anymore, as more and more people want access to Big Cottonwood Canyon, Little Cottonwood Canyon, and Mill Creek. Salt Lake County is mapping out ways to accommodate development while providing environmental protections on the sensitive canyon areas. Today on the program, we're going over the preliminary results of the county's canyon transportation studies and what it could all mean for recreating, living, and doing business in the Wasatch Front Canyons. Joining me in studio is Kelvin Cullimore. He is in his second term as mayor of Cottonwood Heights. And Mayor Cullimore, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Great to be here. We appreciate you having me.
Also with us, Carl Fisher. He's the executive director of the environmental group Save Our Canyons. Carl, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Kathy Kalo is with us from the U.S. Forest Service, and she's joining us by phone. Kathy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you can find out more information and links to Salt Lake County's transportation studies on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we'll profile one of Utah's most influential artists, LeConte Stewart. But first, congestion in the canyons. If you ski, hike, work, or live in Big Cottonwood, Little Cottonwood, or Mill Creek Canyon, what would you like to done to address the traffic and the parking issues in the canyon? How has canyon congestion affected your life in your neighborhood? And what do you think should be done to protect wildlife, the wild places, and the watershed in the canyons? You can join our conversation this morning. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Kathy, I know you've got to get to another meeting, so I'm going to start with you. Last week, Salt Lake County, as I mentioned, released 3 studies on the canyons, one focusing on Mill Creek, one about parking issues in the canyons, and one on transportation, getting people up and down the mountain. Before we get into the recommendations and the conclusions, Kathy, can you give us a bit of background on the studies? I understand the U.S. Forest Service partnered with Salt Lake County to fund these studies. What were the goals initially?
Well, the goals were to look at the Wasatch Front and the increasing demands being placed on the canyons on the front for recreational and economic purposes. And so there's been a well-recognized issue, and then also the growing population that everyone sees before us, and trying to be ahead of the game as the growth continues, and how we want to keep our mountains and canyons in a great condition for recreation and economics. So Salt Lake County was the major convener of a variety of organizations, cities, and groups that were interested in working towards solving the issue and planning for the future. And so they obtained a series of grants to look at some different aspects, parking, and then Mill Creek in particular, and then Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. And the recommendations from those studies were really to look at solving sort of the immediate needs and then some progressive implementation of projects and processes that we can use to improve transportation in those canyons.
From your vantage point at the U.S. Forest Service, I mean, how bad is it? How bad are the problems right now?
Well, the problems are seasonal and primarily winter time access for primarily Little Cottonwood Canyon and then some in Big. and then year-round in Mill Creek. So, and they're all a little bit different in the aspects of the struggles that we're having. And so knowing that we already have congestion at peak times during certain times of the year in each of these canyons, it's time for us to look at them as a whole and how we want to move forward with not only helping people get back and forth to recreate and to work, but also to take care of the area that they're going to, which is a lot of it's national forest and very important to all the residents and visitors that come to Salt Lake area.
In the three studies that were released last week, were any of the elements surprising to you as someone on the front lines?
No, I think many of them were concepts that we have talked about. It was just good to have them all articulated as to the different recommendations and pretty much illustrated how there are different steps we can take towards a better ending for the future, with some easy things we can do and then some more complicated things we can do, and we'll take a little bit more time. Mm.
The three studies outline some short-term solutions, as you mentioned, but also, you know, looking at the big picture, the long-term way to go, and that's going to require more study on environmental impacts, more coordination between local, state, and federal agencies. What role do you see the U.S. Forest Service playing as we move forward?
Well, we would be a cooperator as this future study as far as transportation would. It affects national forest and federal land, as well as any sort of funding that may come would be federal dollars. So we would be involved not from the Forest Service, but necessarily, but from other entities that are more involved in transportation planning and implementation. And we would work with them. We'd be a cooperator with other organizations to look at in more detail about how we might solve some of these transportation needs in the future.
At first blush, do you like the direction that this is going?
Oh, I think it's a great direction in that people are all working together towards trying to look at the issue and resolve it, and there's a lot of momentum right now to go forward. So I think it's a great effort, and I think we'll get something out of it, and that's great.
So how do you think that people visiting the Wasatch Cache National Forest, say in 10 years, will experience the canyons? Do you have any predictions out there?
You know, I think they'll continue to enjoy them. There might be some more definition, if you will, and definement, I guess, of parking areas and travel modes to go in and out of the canyon to their favorite areas, whether it's a ski area, hiking trail. We do need to work together with folks to try to limit the amount of cars that are going up and down the canyon by either carpooling and providing incentives for people to ride together or in a more mass transit type situation. But we do have to be careful about how many people we do want to pump or would be pumping into those canyons, because it could wreck the very experience that people are going there for, and that has to do with the quality of recreation experience that they would have and the natural resources that they're going to enjoy.
Do you foresee something like in Zion or in Yosemite, where it's very restricted, you can only access these areas through a shuttle system or some other sort of mass transit?
Those are definitely a possibility, and those are all the things that we would look at as we move forward as to ways we can work towards solving some of the transportation situations in the future. And even Zion has some seasonal nature to their shuttle, and that's something that we could look at too. And one of the recommendations that came out of for Mill Creek study was for us to explore our shuttle. So those are certainly things that we can be looking at.
Kathy Kahlo with the U.S. Forest Service. Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about the canyon transportation studies that were released by Salt Lake County last week. In studio with me, Carl Fisher, executive director of the environmental group Save Our Canyons, and Colvin Kellamore. He's the mayor of Cottonwood Heights. And you can join our conversation if you like. If you've got questions or comments about the studies, what do you want to see happen to manage the parking, the congestion, the traffic going up Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons as well as Mill Creek Canyon. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Mayor Colomar, I'll start with you. How does canyon traffic affect your community?
Well, Cottonwood Heights, as you know, is the city between the canyons. That's our slogan. And anybody going up Big or Little Cottonwood Canyon usually will have to travel through Cottonwood Heights to arrive at their destination. So whenever there is congestion in the canyons, it has a backup effect into our city. More importantly, as we look at alternatives for the future for transportation in the canyons, and we talk about any kind of bus service, shuttle service, or things of that nature, it begs the question of where do you park the people who are going to use these services? And as we've looked at in the parking study, which was part of this overall study that was released, we need parking facilities at the mouths of these canyons in order to facilitate that. The whole purpose of this was to talk about not just transportation in the canyons, but how do you get people to the canyons? What do you do with them when they get to the mouth of the canyon? And then how do you get them up the canyon so they can access the various activities that they're interested in?
In the study, on a peak ski day, the study shows that 8,000 cars are making their way up these three canyons. The top priority of the study seems to be getting people out of their cars, boosting mass transit. As you mentioned, though, I mean, there's a flow to it. It doesn't begin and end at the canyons. The study has not concluded the best way to move people yet, but did mention bus rapid transit, light rail, even some aerial trams. As the mayor of the adjoining community, the largest adjoining community of these canyons, do you have a preference?
Well, we believe that whatever the mode is for the transportation up the canyons, again, is going to require some accommodations at the base of the canyons. And we really need to back it up beyond that. Part of the reason we had, for instance, Utah Transit Authority as part of our committee is because we need to find ways of getting people to the mouths of the canyon. In other words, we talk about maybe some different modes of transportation up the canyon. That's great, but all that does then is push the problem back down to the mouth of the canyon. In our opinion, one of the things that needs to occur is, you know, ultimately we'd like to see better mass transit, maybe connecting from the tracks lines up to the mouths of the canyon so that we can spread out the demand for parking more than just right at the mouth. Because we can do a lot with parking at the mouth of the canyons, and we are doing a lot. But ultimately, the demand on these canyons is going to increase, and we have to find ways of making those accommodations, which will be more than just accommodating parking at the mouth of the canyon. So from our perspective, do we have a preference of what it is, a gondola, a railroad, or anything like that? I think there's going to have to be all those options explored, and in the end, we're going to have to find the balance between the right environmental impact and the right benefit to transporting the people so that they can have access to these beautiful resources.
Carl Fisher, where is the balance? I mean, that seems to be the rub.
I was just listening to Mayor Cullimore, and I think if he keeps talking like that, we're going to have to put him on our board here soon, because we share a lot of those same concerns. I mean, to us, the interconnection of the resorts or what you do up and down the canyons is kind of the tip of the iceberg. And we need to focus on what's below the surface there, and that's how do we move people around the county. How do we move people from Summit County to Salt Lake County to get them to the Cottonwood Canyon resorts? I think that this study has done a really good job at convening everybody that needs to be at the table to help make the wise decisions. To, you know, it's not a Salt Lake County decision. It's not a state decision. It's not just a Forest Service decision. So everybody has to be at the table to do the right thing for our future.
At first blush, you think that this transportation study is on the right track?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it is going in the right direction. I do wish that there was more emphasis put on what we need to do in the valleys, some of those discussions about, you know, not just what we do up Big Cottonwood or up Little Cottonwood or up Mill Creek or up Parley's, but what we do getting people from the new airport tracks line to a trailhead in Little Cottonwood Canyon or to Brighton Ski Resort or to Park City without having to rent a car or get in a taxi cab or something like that. You know, we need to change people's mindsets, not only residents but visitors to this area, that you can fly into Salt Lake City and you can be to your destination and a recreation place in half hour, 45 minutes without having to rent a car.
Carl Fisher with the environmental group Save Our Canyons, also with us, Mayor Kelvin Cullimore with Cottonwood Heights, and we're talking about canyon transportation, a new study released by Salt Lake County last week on how to deal with the traffic and the parking issues that are plaguing the Wasatch Front Canyons. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. More mass transit. That's one of the big recommendations of a new report on transportation issues in the Wasatch Front Canyons. But it doesn't yet say which form of transit. We're talking more buses or a rail line or a gondola. What would work best? Today on the program, we're talking about ways to remedy the traffic and the congestion and the parking issues so familiar to canyon users today, Big Cottonwood, Little Cottonwood, and Mill Creek. If you'd like to join our conversation, what solutions would you like to see when it comes to alleviating the congestion in the Cottonwoods or in Mill Creek? If you walk your dog in Mill Creek, you're familiar with it. If you ride your bike through the canyons, you're familiar with the congestion. Give us a call. Let us know what your ideas are. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. With me in studio is Cottonwood Heights Mayor Kelvin Cullimore and Carl Fisher with the group Save Our Canyons. 801-355-TALK is our number. So let's talk about some of the specific ideas that these three studies mention. Let's turn to the environmental impacts. More people in the canyons, more development. It could affect water quality. We're talking air quality issues. How do you balance that access to people to enjoy the canyons with the environmental concerns there? Carl Fisher?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a huge challenge. And not only, I mean, we have, you know, the Forest Service has a process for evaluating impacts on forest health. But also you have Salt Lake City, who's responsible for the watershed health solely. And they try to partner with a lot of the other municipalities to get some of that. But we do have to come, and it's hard for each and every one of us to admit it, but our own individual use of the canyons is what's killing or degrading these canyons, each person that goes up there. And so how do you mitigate that, you know? And what we do for transportation, whatever the mode is, it's going to change the land use patterns in those canyons. And so that's what we need to really evaluate, is what the land use patterns are going to look like in the future and what the impacts we can expect on the watershed, on the forest, on the recreational experience, on wildlife, on, you know, are we going to be fragmenting wildlife corridors, what's left of some of the intact ecosystems in the Wasatch Canyons. So those are all things we're going to have to look at, and it's all mode dependent, and it's all dependent on how that mode dictates the future of land use.
Mm. Mayor Cullimore, I imagine that the environmental issues were a central part of the discussions that the working group, the study group, looked at. I mean, what were kind of the top concerns on your agenda?
Of course. I mean, the Salt Lake City was part of this because watershed is a top concern. We have to protect the watershed. I mean, that's everybody's top priority. You don't have to be an environmentalist to understand that. We believe that's a key priority. And it's really kind of interesting when you talk about development in the canyons. I really don't think the issue is development, because there's not a huge demand for development in the canyons per se. I think, as Carl said, I think the bigger challenge is going to be how do we regulate the use of the canyons? Because, ironically, the whole idea of providing greater modes of transportation probably means we're actually going to make it more accessible. And the more people that are up there, you know, I don't believe it's just the ski industry. I think there's a misperception. In fact, we studied this as part of our committee. The ski industry is certainly one of the industries that's involved with this. But when you talk about outdoor recreation, it goes way beyond just the ski industry. And I think Carl could give you some numbers on that, that we're talking about backcountry skiers, hikers. We're talking about canyons that are going to become more in demand year-round. Right now, granted, the main concern is handling the transportation during the winter months. But the demand on these canyons is increasing in the summer times as well, and we're seeing that. And so, obviously, from a community perspective, we'd like to see more development down in the valley and at the mouths of the canyons to support development for use of the canyons. We think that may be a more appropriate approach. But in the end, we also have to have discussions about not just what is the environmental impact of more cars in the canyon, but more people in the canyon. I mean, it's a treasure. These canyons are a treasure, and people are going to want to use them, and we need to try and do everything we can to make them accessible and usable, but we have to balance that with the environmental impacts.
You mentioned the need for more parking structures at the mouth of the canyon to allow people to take the shuttles and the buses and all that. The study recommends a new park and ride on Wasatch Boulevard, improving some parking areas within the canyons, restricting parking in other areas. I mean, what are your thoughts on these ideas? Will they work?
Well, we've gone beyond just thoughts. We've got plans for parking at the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon. We have one development going in where the old Canyon Racquet Club was that is going to add almost 1,000 parking spots for use of the public, which I think is fabulous. We've got two parking areas, our Timberline Trail parking area, and then we're going to be working on parking improvements along Fort Union Boulevard. We are doing more than just thinking about it. There are actual plans in place and funding mechanisms that have been identified for accomplishing that.
When would those be online then?
In the next 5 years. We'll have some of those online. But put it in perspective. I mean, even if we added 2,000 parking spots to the mouth of the canyon, long term, we're not touching the greater need, but it's at least a start. And I don't think we'd like to see, most people don't want to see, you know, six-story parking structures at the mouth of the canyon. That's just not what it's about. And so could we do more, be more creative? I think we can. But again, it comes back to the issue of, can you do it all right at the mouth? No, you really can't. You've got to back it up and find ways of making the transportation modes more or broader so that they can get to the mouth of the canyon without having to drive their car there. I mean, that would be ideal. Someday maybe a tracks line up 94th or Fort Union, you know, 30 years from now, that may very well be one of the main modes of transportation so that people don't have to do that.
The study does recommend improving the access points from the University of Utah to make sure, I mean, it is looking at the big picture in some respects, but I mean, is parking, where does Save Our Canyons come down on that? Parking structures at the mouth of the canyon?
Yeah, I don't think we really want to be built. I don't think building parking structures at the mouth of the canyon is just like adding lanes to the interstate highway, right? It alleviates the problem in a temporary fashion, but it's not a long-term solution. It might help a little bit, but I think, like Mayor Cullimore said, we do need to figure out, you know, how are we going to get people from the airport, from the university, from Summit County to these canyons without having to even get in their car. Because I think about it myself, I have a wife, I have a kid on the way. We're going to be wanting to go skiing up at the resorts at some point. So I leave my house, I load my car up with our ski boots and our skis and our backpacks and maybe a sack lunch. Then we drive to a park and ride. and we get on a bus where I offload all the stuff that I just loaded on 15 minutes ago, try and put the skis under one arm and the kid under the other, and, you know, cram onto a ski bus or a train or what have you, and then get to the resort and yet again unload. How many times are people going to want to load and unload their stuff every time you transfer off a bus? You know, that is something that degrades a person's experience, whether you're a local or a tourist. And whether you're here in the wintertime to enjoy the ski resorts or whether you are hauling climbing gear and a mountain bike up the canyons, you know, it's those types of things that we have to address, where you can get on a tracks train, maybe make one transfer and get on a mode. But, you know, you don't want to have people carting and lugging stuff all across the valley, dropping gloves all along the way.
Mm. The long-term solutions do include a tracks line. They do include an aerial tram or a gondola, a bus rapid transit, which mm-hmm. is kind of like a tracks line on rubber wheels. But, I mean, does Save Our Canyons see the... one or favor one mode above another at this point?
I think, you know, for us at this point in time, that we need to really look at how we can change people's mindsets towards utilizing transportation. And I think the most efficient and effective way of doing that is by just adding buses and getting more buses and maybe looking at the bus rapid transit. If that catches on and people can do it, you know, rail lines don't come cheap. Buses aren't cheap either, but they're cheaper than rail lines.
It was like $500 million or something as an estimate for a rail line, and that's wow.
Right. So, I mean, I think we need to be cognizant of the costs of some of these things and slowly work to change people's mindset. And the thing I like about buses is that you can add bus routes, you can try them out, and then you can just remove them. It's not like you have to tear up a rail line that was, you know, poorly aligned, or it was like, oh, I wish, you know, 5 years after the fact we would have done this. So, you know, for me, the buses and having buses that don't make tons of stops in the valley is one thing that we can look at right now and start seeing how that's received by the public. Because at the end of the day, those are the people that have to use it.
Mayor Cullimore, you pointed out that it's not just skiers using the canyons. There's a whole range of people who are looking for recreation opportunities mm-hmm. in the canyons, hikers. And I'm thinking of cyclists and pedestrians who have to share the road with cars right now. How are transportation planners thinking about this coexistence and making it safe for everybody?
Well, that's an ongoing challenge. Anytime you are, the roads are supposed to be used by all modes of transportation. We've become a very car-centric society. And so a lot of people get frustrated with bicyclists who have every right to use the road as much as the cars do. And so that is something, you know, obviously having bike lanes going up the canyon would be a great thing. We have laws that protect bicyclists and people, but I think those are some of the things that are going to have to be done. But to Carl's point, I think one of the things that we're facing here, we've done studies for the canyons for decades, and this continues to be an issue because everybody recognizes it is. Answers are not easy to find. There are going to be multiple options, but in the end, a lot of it is going to be fiscally constrained. I mean, you can't just clock down $500 million to run a railroad up Little Cottonwood Canyon just because you think it's a good idea. It's going to have to be fiscally constrained. It's going to have to be proven out economically that that's the best way to do it. And one of the reasons why these are difficult is because of the convenience that Carl was talking about. People are not going to make changes in their lifestyle just because they want to be good citizens in that regard. They're going to do what is convenient. One of these days, though, we're going to cross over that line where it's no longer going to be convenient to take your car up, and then people are going to demand, saying, well, why didn't we do something about this? You know, all of a sudden, that we'll cross that line of people saying, it's just impossible to access the canyons anymore. It's just, and everybody will start crying, we need a solution. Our job right now is to be anticipating that. We're not going to compel people to all of a sudden just start taking buses because we think it's a good idea. As long as it's still convenient to use their cars, they're going to do that. But we need to be anticipating what's going to happen over the next decade or so. And that's why I really like the studies that are going on right now. I think Salt Lake County was visionary in their approach to this and saying, you know, we're not talking about next year. We're not even talking about 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. We're talking about the future. When our valley has another 1 million people in it and demand on these canyons really increases, we better be prepared for options. We better have thought it out ahead of time. So my guess is on a lot of the options that are mentioned in this study, we may not see implementation of a gondola, you know, in 5 years from now. We may not see a train. We may not see a tracks line immediately. But if we don't start planning now and anticipating what that need may be down the road, there won't be enough time to react when the demand gets here. And so our goal is to make sure that we push these studies forward so that we know what the options are, fiscally constrained, and are able to implement things one step at a time as we move forward. And I think if everybody will keep that mindset, we're not all of a sudden going to come out with a huge solution that's just going to change everything tomorrow. This is a process. It's going to take several years to work through the process and even many years beyond that to implement.
Let's go to our callers. Sterling calling from Bountiful has been holding. Sterling, good morning. Thanks so much for the call.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I really appreciate this discussion. I really love the, you know, our canyons. I really love you know, the outdoors. I love skiing. You know, my wife and I were talking yesterday. We were thinking, well, you know, Carl Fisher kind of mentioned this, you know, with kids and everything. We wanted to take up our kid to the after three ski free up at, I think it's at Alta. And we live up in, you know, Bountiful area. And we were thinking, well, if we go up there, you know, for 3 o'clock, we're going to get stuck in all that congestion. And I believe you had said that, you know, the average skier spends 3 hours of the day, you know, in their car.
In those peak times, yeah.
Yeah, in those peak times. And, you know, that's just uncalled for. And I kind of agree with Mayor Colemore that, you know, the people of Salt Lake or the area are going to cross that line. And I think we've crossed that line. I think it's time that we make some changes and we you know, this has kind of been studied off and on for 30 years, you know, interconnecting our resorts or transportation options, and I think it's time that we act. You know, I think we can't just study, and then we get in this analysis paralysis. You know, I think there's projects that are short-term options, and there's also long-term visionary options that are on the table right now, and that we should act. I believe that aerial transportation is going to be a big part of that solution. And so those are some of my comments, and I'll hang up now. So
Sterling, thanks so much for the call. I guess there is a timeline to this next phase, the final phase of the studies, which involves the environmental impacts. 3 years. So we have momentum. People are thinking about what are we going to do? And there's some political will there. Is it enough to push it over the top, as Sterling has suggested? Mayor Colemore?
Well, as Sterling pointed out, we'd like to see some action. But as I mentioned earlier, you can't just start pouring money into a solution if there's not the public support for it. You've got to build the public support first, and then you can do that. There are many, like Sterling, who have recognized that we may have already crossed that line, but we need more to feel that way before the kind of money that's needed can be generated. But we can't do anything until we get the NEPA study or the environmental impact studies done. That's going to take several years so that we have a foundation from which to build any solution. We have to also make sure that we are being sensitive to all of the various inputs. So while it does appear that there's some sort of analysis paralysis, one thing I've recognized is that any kind of process like this is not efficient. It takes time. You have to take the time to get all the input, and that does appear to be sort of analysis paralysis. But I think it's necessary. I think it's necessary to make sure that we have examined all the options, measure 10 times, cut once.
Carl, our time is very short, so I'll give you the last word. I mean, what are your priorities as you push for the final product at the end? You know, what is it going to be at the end of the tunnel if Save Our Canyons gets their way?
Well, I think that we'll be able to enjoy a lot of what we enjoy today, the vistas, the view sheds, high water quality, you know, great wild spaces to go recreate in. The thing that is going to change, I think, is how we get there. And that's a challenge. But I will say that everybody from the ski resorts to the environmental community to elected officials all agree that something needs to be done. And the approach and the fashion in which these studies have been put together is unprecedented. Studies that have been done in the past 30 years have been fairly mode specific in looking at only one piece of the problem. This is looking at everything. And by looking at everything, that's the only way we're going to build the public trust and support.
Carl Fisher with Save Our Canyons. Carl, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks.
And Mayor Kelvin Cullimore with Cottonwood Heights. Mayor, thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And again, you can find more information and links to Salt Lake County's transportation studies on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, LeConte Stewart and the Art of Isolation. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Friends remember LeConte Stewart setting up an easel and paints in his neighbor's driveway and capturing the lonely barns and the wide open spaces of Kaysville on his canvas. One of Utah's major talents, Stewart reveled in creating impressionist-influenced landscapes and depicting structures in rural isolation. And today on the program, we're discussing a new book that explores Stewart's unique brand of Depression-era art and his legacy as an art teacher. And the book is titled LeConte Stewart Masterworks. Joining me in studio is Dr. Donna Poulton. She is the curator of the Art of Utah and the West at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. She's also one of the co-authors of the book. And Donna, great to have you here. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also in studio, Dr. James Poulton. He's a psychologist in private practice here in Salt Lake City. And he is also one of the co-authors of the book. And Jim, welcome to you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Also with us on the phone, Dr. Vern Swanson, director of the Springville Museum of Art. And he's joining us by phone from his home in Springville. And Dr. Swanson, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Donna Poulton, James Poulton, Vern Swanson, along with Mary Muir and Robert Davis. They're all co-authors of this new book, LeConte Stewart, Masterworks, published by Gibbs Smith. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you're a former student of LeConte Stewart or a collector or just an admirer, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Donna, I'll start with you. You write that LeConte Stewart is considered Utah's most important landscape painter. Why?
You know, he painted for nearly 90 years. He grew up in Utah. He has a huge oeuvre of work. He was devoted to the landscape. He was devoted to the farmers. He was actually devoted to this 80-mile stretch along the Wasatch Front, where he went out every day and did his plein air work. A lot of artists today, for example, will go out and do a study and then go back to the studio and create a major painting. But LeConte Stewart not only painted his studies outdoors, he actually painted many of his major easel pieces outdoors. And he really painted out the region. And I think if we look at who the important artists are in Utah, Mahone Rai Young as a sculptor, or Cyrus Dallin, those two were important American artists who were sculptors. Our most important painter is Lacan Stewart.
Mm. Jim Poulton, as Donna mentioned, he really focused on the land, but interestingly, not on Utah's dramatic Red Rock, where so many artists are drawn to that. Instead, he set his sights on this quiet farmland in northern Utah, the vistas of Weber and Davis and Morgan counties. What caught his eye about that particular landscape, do you think?
It's interesting. I think it was the serenity of the landscape. Many of his paintings, many of the landscape paintings, are long-distance perspectives with maybe a farmhouse or a ranch house in the foreground, but a hillside in the background that is sort of like a caressing hillside. It lends a quality of peacefulness or of things in their place. Mm. And I think he was really drawn to that.
Vern Swanson, you note that Lacan Stewart's mother died when he was 12. You note that the death of his father also made a real impression on him and on his outlook and on his art. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, you know, anytime you have the death of a loved one close to you, I don't think that the death of his father was quite as instrumental in his art as the death of his mother, which happened when he was much younger, and he was slightly separated from his father because of his stepmother. However, Lacan was bereft of his family, siblings and parents fairly early in his life, and needed to find a refuge, which an uncle was thankfully able to give him in Salt Lake City. But he was an artist who pretty much had to make it on his own without the family structure to support him. And so his work, I think Jim Poulton has wonderfully noted how there's a certain isolation in his work, and you begin the segment by saying, Lacan Stewart, artist of isolation. But I also think that Jim hit it just on the nail when he said, artist of serenity. And the vast majority of his works show the beautiful meditative quality of the Utah agrarian landscape. And so the loss of family was a major part of his ethos, the pathos that he showed in his work. And so I think that he was able to in some ways overcome that, in some ways embrace that.
Mm. Speaking with Vern Swanson, director of the Springville Museum of Art, also with us in studio, Donna Poulton, curator at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, and Dr. Jim Poulton, a psychologist in private practice. All three are among the co-authors of a new volume, Lacan Stewart Masterworks, and you can find links to that on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about Lacan Stewart, who had a tremendous footprint here in the artistic community in Utah. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Donna, you quote someone in your essay on Lacan Stewart saying that he painted the raw side of life. Mm-hmm. And while he was a teacher in Ogden, some found his work subversive.
Right.
It's interesting. You don't typically think of a landscape, farmland, open spaces as subversive. Can you tell us about that episode in his painting career?
Yeah. You know, during the Depression, he was painting work that had more isolation to it. For example, The Green Front is a painting where it is the front of a store. It looks very isolated. It looks closed. It looks like a victim of the Depression, when in fact he was such an introspective person. He really liked to paint when no one was around. So originally, when we wrote the label for that, we thought, oh, well, this store was a victim of the Depression, when in fact we researched it, we found out it was a going concern. So he went out and painted this early in the morning or late at night when no one was around. And so he liked to paint those kinds of things, empty factories, empty houses. But he did also paint, for example, Home Loan, a boarded up house that was a victim of repossession by the bank. He painted hobos on a train going through town. He painted a Toehold, which I think is a masterpiece, his work. A home that couldn't quite be finished, so they were living in the basement and just put a roof on the top. It wasn't finished. So apparently people
was in, he overtly political? Do you think?
No, he never seemed to be. But people in Ogden, especially in the Ogden school system where he taught at the time, felt that these particular paintings were subversive, and that he should be fired for it. And I feel that, to be fired during the height of the Depression when you have a family to feed is a very terrifying thing. And I think after that, he quit painting those paintings. There are a number of reasons he quit painting those paintings. One was he had a new job at the university, and the decade had kind of played itself out. I do believe, however, that if he had had a choice in life and these charges hadn't been brought against him, I think he would have continued to paint in the same way Hopper painted for the rest of his life. So not just quitting at the Depression, but going on with these kinds of images.
Jim, would you agree?
Yeah, I would. The Depression became a sort of focal point for LeConte Stewart. The imagery from the Depression matched his personal psychology. And it fascinated him, and he wanted to explore, as he said, the raw side of life, the muck, he said, of life. So those images were really sort of near and dear to his heart, and I think they were, because of that, they were seen as subversive, because he wanted to explore the ugly underbelly of what had happened during the Depression.
Vern Swanson, in your essay, you note that LeConte Stewart spent his life teaching rather than focusing on his painting. And you write that that is perhaps the greatest tragedy of his career. Why do you see teaching as opposed to focusing on the painting as a tragedy?
Teaching is not a travesty for everybody else. It's a blessing, and that certainly was a blessing for Utah art in one respect, but that he maintained a teaching career throughout his life without until retirement time at the age of 65, when his best years were past him. Wouldn't we have loved to have seen more paintings, maybe larger paintings, more considered works, rather than him going out on Saturday or after school and doing his work? The hours that you're in the classroom are really the best part of the day, where you're the most energetic and you can do your best work, rather than after a hard day you go out into the fields and you paint a painting or maybe try to catch a Saturday when you have a full family and you should maybe do something with the family as well. So with all these concerns, dealing with LeConte Stewart as a practicing painter rather than the other artistic considerations that he offered to the community, artistic community of Utah, what would have happened? Would he have been able to operate on a maybe more national level if he had spent the best hours of the day doing his artwork rather than teaching other people how to do it? Well, so and that's a tragedy because he was so good. Being the best painter, you would like to see him do the best paintings and more of them. Not to say he wasn't prolific. He really was.
But it was in the spare moments of his life. We've only got about 30 seconds left, and I guess, Donna, I'll ask you quickly, because you mentioned he painted every day, well into his 90s. I mean, what do you see as the legacy for today's landscape artists here in Utah? 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would say learn in some way the way LeConte did. I mean, he read a lot. He took a lot of classes. John Carlson was his inspiration. Every good artist that I know has John Carlson's book on his shelf. Go out and paint. Spend the time outdoors sketching. LeConte Stewart did 4 and 5 sketches a day before he actually painted the painting. Look at the shadows, spend the time, get the feeling of the outdoors. A lot of people now are painting from pictures, and it's really pretty obvious. And I think to do the work he did was exceptional in the heart of winter, just to spend that time outdoors.
Dr. Donna Poulton, Dr. James Poulton, and Dr. Vern Swanson, thank you all very much for the time. I appreciate it. The book is LeConte Stewart, Masterworks, and we'll have links on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.